We're going to continue with carbohydrates today. First, we're going to start with just an overview of a few derivatives that can be formed from carbohydrates. What happens if we react carbohydrates with some certain sets of reagents. We're then going to talk about what's known as a glycoside, a derivative of a sugar where you effectively turn it into an acetal or a ketal by reacting it with an alcohol. Well, since sugars themselves are polyols, you could say, we're then going to extend that and learn how we can connect one sugar to another, which means we're going to start learning some disaccharides, such as sucrose and maltose, sugars that are complex and have two smaller sugar units that make them up. So first, some of these carbohydrate derivatives. So for our first example, which sugar is this? Mannose, that's right. And if we were to react mannose with sodium borohydride followed up by acidic workup. Oh gosh, yes. So if we reduce that with sodium borohydride, what would you expect to get? You'll get an alcohol because we have an aldehyde to start with. So in other words, we end up with a molecule in which every carbon has an alcohol group on it. As a general term, these are called aldehydes. And a lot of these derivatives that we're going to see, both here and once we get to the Fischer stereochemistry proof, a lot of these derivatives, you take the same ending, like this is aldehyde. You take that ital ending and put it on another name, and that's how you could name these derivatives. So if you have mannose, this is then called mannitol. Now, if someone with one of these fancy electronic devices wouldn't mind looking this up, I know that sorbitol is a common sweetener, and if my recall is working, sorbitol is another name for glucitol, in other words, the derivative of glucose. So if someone wouldn't mind confirming that for me. While we're doing that, let me show you the next form of derivative. Which sugar is this? Talose, the last one. Turns out that if you react that with an aqueous solution of bromine, it is able to selectively oxidize the aldehyde and the primary alcohol. So in other words, just the aldehyde. The mechanism for this is generally not presented in first year OChem textbooks. I'm not sure exactly why. So I will try to find that mechanism and see if it's worthwhile to discuss. But at the moment, we just need to know what the result is, which is that we get a monocarboxylic acid. I'm sorry? It is glucitol. Okay, so it is, the sorbitol is the derivative of glucose. So this compound that we just made, this is called an aldolic acid. And specifically then, this would be D-talonic acid. Last one is now the case where we do oxidize that primary alcohol and the aldehyde. Let's see. Which sugar is this? Altrose, that's right. And it turns out that nitric acid is able to accomplish that selective oxidation. Of course, not if you had a concentrated solution of nitric acid. But this particular derivative we'll see extensively featured in the Fischer stereochem proof. This is called an aldaric acid. And so this would be D-altraric acid. And again, generally, there's no explanation given as to why it is just the primary alcohols that can be oxidized is just declared to be so. So I'll try to find, again, a mechanism for that as well to see if it's worthwhile. Otherwise, we just need to know what these three derivatives are. So are there any questions on the derivatives? Then let's get towards this discussion of something known as a glycoside. Before we can get there, though, I need to return to cyclic sugars because we need to talk about their reactivity a little bit. So let's look at the alpha D form of glucopyranose. And what does the pyranose part of that name mean? It's a six-membered ring. The D form is the regular form, so in linear glucose, what would be the configuration of OH groups as we go from bottom from top to bottom? It would be right, left, right, right. Well, let's see if we can get to a Haworth projection without first writing that linear structure, because there's a few observations that now that we've already seen Haworth projections we can make. Well, just so that we're not totally just staring into space on this one, let me draw linear glucose, linear D-glucose, to point out that when we do try to visualize this from the Haworth projection, we want to try to take whatever oxygen that becomes part of the ring and put it into the backbone of the projection. And so if we're making aldohexopyranoses, so in other words, if we're always going to be taking this last stereocenter's OH group in order to make that ring, then if we're trying to properly visualize, that means we're always going to turn it clockwise, which means the CH2OH group is always going to end up on the left-hand side. Again, if we're making a six-membered ring sugar out of a D sugar. So if we wanted to jump to the Haworth projection then, for this and all other D sugars, the back CH2OH group will always be on top. That's if you're doing a standard Haworth projection where the enomer position goes on the right. Now, if I want to make the alpha form, alpha means that the anomeric OH group is trans on the ring relative to this CH2OH group, which if that group is always up for D sugars, that means alpha is always going to be down for D sugars, again when drawn in the standard configuration. then following the standard visualization, anything that's on the right-hand side of the Fisher projection is going to be on the bottom of the ring. Anything that's on the left-hand side of the Fisher projection is going to be on the top of the ring. So I could look at this and say right, left, right, right. Or I could tilt myself sideways and look at the ring and say bottom, top, bottom, bottom. But remember, we have to twist that last stereo center. So as far as these first three, though, bottom, top, bottom. And this would be alpha D glucopyranose, which has a specific rotation of plus 112.2 degrees. Now, we haven't talked numerically about what specific rotation is, but it is how much light is twisted as it passes a specific distance through a solution of a specific concentration. So we had only talked nebulously about optical rotation in that enantiomers are going to have opposite rotations. So, for example, this is plus 112.2 degrees. Its enantiomer is going to have an optical rotation, a specific rotation of negative 112.2 degrees. Now, it's observed, though, that if we take the pure version of this and put it into solution, that over time, we're going to end up with an optical rotation value of 52.7 degrees. Now, why might we think that should be? What could be going on solution that would cause that to change? Steric hindrance? If we had a reaction of two things, what kind of reaction would be going on then? Dimerization? Unlikely if we just put it in water, not impossible. What kind of functional group is this in the ring form? It comes from an aldehyde, so it is what? Well, we did a protonate open attack deprotonate on this. So it's a functional group that has two oxygens connected to a common carbon, which means it's one of four things, a hemiacetal, an acetal, a hemiketal, or a ketal. I know that this quarter we had carboxylic acid derivatives, so you might have been tempted to say ester or something like that, but realize there's no carbonyl once we actually cyclize the ring. But if you remember last quarter when we did hydrates and acetals and ketals, the way we identified those functional groups was, again, by there being two oxygens connected to just one carbon. Now, on top of that, though, we have a hydrogen present. And on one of the two oxygens, there's only a hydrogen. With the hydrogen present on that carbon, we know it's either an acetal or hemiacetal, and it's a hemiacetal because only one of the oxygens has an R group on it. Why does that matter? Because when we had learned these functional groups, I had said that generally hemiacetals and hemiketals are not isolatable. They easily either form acetals or they decompose back to their original aldehyde. Well, this is a hemiacetal that turns out to be stable because we have so many intramolecular interactions going on, all these OH groups interacting with each other. And in aqueous solution, at least, this is extremely compatible with water. I mean, all these sugars are water soluble. So, what if the ring were to open up? Because if the ring opens up, it becomes planar again, doesn't it? and that if it were to try to reclose and reform the ring, that means even though you started with the alpha form, there's a possibility that upon the reclosure of that ring, you're going to have the beta form instead.
Which, let me just, so we can talk about it, draw its structure up.
Just totally disappeared.
Okay. So here is beta D glucopyranose. Which, what should its specific rotation value be? We didn't just fall into the trap, did we? Oh, we did. Why? What's the relationship between these two compounds? What are they? They're not enantiomers, no. What are they? They're epimers, because there's only one stereocenter difference between the two. Enantiomers, yes, are mirror images, and therefore if one has a plus rotation, one has an equal but opposite rotation. That's mirror image form. But epimers are not mirror images. They're distinct molecules that have nothing to do with each other in terms of physical properties. So if we do know the optic rotation for the alpha form, we don't know anything about the beta form, because there is no relationship between epimers.
So it's a trick question, I recognize, but kind of not. It's tricky only if you don't keep in mind that these, again, are epimers. So knowing the optical rotation of the alpha anomer does not allow us to predict the optical rotation of the beta anomer. And that's because the two compounds are epimers, which means there's no connection between their optical rotation. Now what's happening then, or actually let me tell you, there is a real optical rotation. It turns out to be plus 18.7 degrees. Which, notice, 52.7, which is the angle that both of these adopt, is not the average of the two compounds. Which means you don't necessarily have a 50-50 mixture of the two compounds in solution. But whichever compound you start with, it's going to achieve equilibrium with its opposites, with alpha and beta. And since that we will achieve an equilibrium, that's why whichever one of these we put into solution, we get the same degree of rotation after some time. This process of that specific form entering into equilibrium with its opposite form, that's known as mutarotation. And as I'll write down in just a moment, the exact proportion of which one of these two is going to form depends on exactly the structure of the compound. So let me write this bit about what mutarotation is first. Let me cheat and look at my wording yesterday. Whenever a pure sample of one anomer of an aldopyranose is placed in solution, actually, it doesn't even have to be an aldose or whatever. Anything that's got an anomer position could technically open and close. So whenever a pure sample of one anomer of a cyclic sugar is placed in solution, that anomer will interconvert with its opposite form, until an equilibrium between the two forms is established. Resulting in an equilibrium optical rotation. Not equal, but equilibrium. No, not at all. In fact, that's the very next thing I was going to write down, what I mentioned a moment ago. That if you think about just the sugar itself, depending whether the OH groups are up or down, maybe they'll interact with each other across the ring. And so for different sugars, maybe, I don't think this is true, I don't think the five-membered ring becomes more favorable, but you might have more of the five-membered ring for some reason, or less for a particular sugar. Or the alpha versus beta forms, you know, if we made a chair structure out of this, we might wonder whether the alpha form puts that OH group on the axial versus the equatorial position. Of course, whether it ends up on the axial or equatorial position will depend on how the other groups interact to determine which of those two forms is more favorable. So maybe for one sugar, the alpha is more favorable. Maybe for another sugar, maybe the beta is more favorable. So the exact proportion of this in any of the forms that form in solution depends on the unique intramolecular interactions that happen for that particular sugar. And it's not just these two forms that we're talking about here for this previous example that could form. Glucose could form a five-membered ring. And when it formed that five-membered ring, again, you're going to form an alpha and a beta anomer. So if you're given some form, any form, of D-glucose, when you put it in solution, you're going to get alpha D-glucofuranose beta-D glucofuranose, alpha-D glucopyranose, and beta-D glucopyranose. And again, the exact proportion of the cyclic forms of a sugar that will form in solution depend on the intramolecular interactions that will occur for that particular sugar. Still blurry, isn't it? So that's it as far as ring opening and closing. We've pretty much gone over all aspects of this that we need to for this course. If we were really concerned, we could talk about numbers, but this is not a physical organic chemistry course. So are there any questions about this? Then let's continue to glycosides now. And although I overuse glucose as an example generally, we are going to be leading up to these disaccharides, so we might as well get some practice with glucose because glucose is found in a lot of these more complex sugars. So let's start with the alpha D six-membered ring form of glucose again. Which, as you will see, we're going to start writing mechanisms with. So if it hasn't been clear enough yet that you need to be proficient at writing these cyclic structures, well, hopefully my gentle warning that you need to be able to do so will be. In other words, if it takes you 5 minutes just to write down glucose in a ring, if it's one of a series of mechanisms that you need to write, it's going to be kind of a problem where time is concerned. So if I reacted this with acid and methanol, what do you think is going to happen? Let's say there's an excess of methanol. Ooh, but it's not an ester. And it just happens to be you that said that, but each of the three sections, more than one person said that. It's because we're so programmed with carboxylic acids right now. But it is a protonate open attack deprotonate sequence, so I can understand why you said that. What would be the more appropriate term then? Is there making an ester? We would take the hemiacetal and make an acetal, right? We would push it to completion, you could say. But the mechanism is not quite what we've seen in the past, because I know I'm referring to this kind of by just looking at the board. Some of you might need to see this written, but it would be good practice then for you to go back and try to do this on your own. Realize that the way that this hemiacetal formed is because there used to be a carbonyl here. And generally, if we're going through sequences of protonate open attack deprotonate, this is the regular sequence. I've got it backwards in my head. This would have been after the first step of protonate open attack deprotonate. To finish it off, we would protonate this up. other OH group, let it leave as water, and then the next alcohol comes in. So we'll do just that. So protonate. We're going to have an open step, but it turns out this is a case where the resonance aspect really matters. So I'm going to write the lone pair of the neighboring oxygen, the one that's in the ring, as having an active role in kicking this group off. Because notice what we form. We have a planar intermediate, which means that when methanol comes into attack, it's got two different directions that it could attack from, above and below the ring. Now, I'm going to write something down, and then I will explain the way I've written it in response to a concern that came up in one of the other sections. Because I've just used this split arrow to show, to highlight that there's two attacks possible. If I only wanted you to show the mechanism to form one product, of course you wouldn't use a split arrow like this. However, I'm doing so because I've just said that two attacks are possible. And that brings up a point related to some of the notes, because I heard from more than one person some concern when they got the exams back, oh, you had this written in your notes. And my comment back was, what was I saying at that time? Because yes, I might have something in writing, like I had the deprotonation of malonic ester with sodium hydroxide. If sodium hydroxide was used as a concentrated solution, you wouldn't be able to just deprotonate, you would saponify. But if you're careful, you can just deprotonate. So you need to know the context under which that sodium hydroxide was written. Same thing here. The context of showing the split arrow is to highlight the fact that you have both attacks possible. Notice also that if this is a cationic mechanism, shouldn't I really be using reversible arrows everywhere? But, you know, we have discussed this idea of reversibility. I know that some of you probably studied it in a panic for the exam. There is always the chance that reversibility will come back as a topic later on. But in this case, I'm more worried about showing the glycoside, what the product is, and without necessarily getting hung up in the details of the mechanism. Because although it's important to show you those details, at some point we back off and just say, what's the practical? What are we making? So, if I'm asking you to show me how to make a glycoside, I'm comfortable with you writing the mechanism exactly the way that I am now. If I ask you something about reversibility, then, of course, that's a signal to you to get worried about the reversible arrows. Does that make sense, what I just said, as far as what I'm going to be looking for? So, in other words, I didn't put reversible arrows, and in this case, I don't care. I care what's the glycoside, because we're out of mechanistic chemistry. The rest of this quarter is just descriptive chemistry. What are carbohydrates? What are amino acids? What are terpenes? What are lipids? So I'd rather focus on that. Any questions about that statement? Then, back to here, we do get two products. Now, since there's a deprotonation step, which means I have to write all the molecules yet again. Can we all accept me just saying minus H plus? Okay. You all seem particularly quiet today. The lab quiz wasn't a surprise, was it? No. Okay. Would I make any of you smile if I referred to the picture that showed up on the Facebook group?
Would it make you smile even more that after that picture got taken and posted, and if you don't know what I'm talking about, go take a look at it, because even I laughed. Someone had erased it and put a burrito in the middle and called it burritos. So, yes. Go. You'll laugh when you see the picture. Someone was in a mood when I left the room. Someone that I will track down. I say that because apparently Section 1 and 2 listens to this section's recording sometimes. Do you listen to Section 1 and 2's, you all? No. So here we're getting the alpha and beta forms of this new acetal. I mean, in fact, point out that now we truly have an acetal. The exact proportion of which the alpha versus beta forms is an important topic, and there's a discussion known as the anomeric effect that is in your text. I'm going to skip over that today to focus on the disaccharides, which is where this is all leading to. Because notice we've just linked a sugar with an alcohol. A sugar is an alcohol, and so the next step is to show one sugar linking with the next. It is exactly, though, this connection from the anomer position to something else that makes it a glycoside. Well, I say that. Some texts say that, no, that's only specifically when a sugar is connected to a sugar. Some texts are more liberal with the use of the term. I'm not worried about the subtleties in this case because I'm not a carbohydrate chemist. So this is a good enough definition for us. Now, there's one variation of this that I'll show you, which is if we were to take something like glucose, and react it with an amine, or maybe even just plain old ammonia. It turns out that an amine can substitute at that anomeric position as well. Which I'll be lazy and just use a squiggly arrow. Which you may feel free to do so under the appropriate circumstances as well. This is an N glycoside, because we have a nitrogen in there instead, and since we have glucose that's been derivatized to have an amine functionality, this is glucosamine. Yes. You're correct. Questions. Then, let's now get to these complex sugars. So I earlier use this term monosaccharide, which essentially means one sugar unit. Which, what does that mean? Well, we could observe that in all the sugars we've seen so far, all those halohexoses that you have to
memorized, the pentoses, the tetroses, the couple of ketoses. There's no glycosidic linkages. Or another way we could say it is there's only one carbonyl. Now, yes, once we go into cyclic form, there's no carbonyl, but there's one hidden then, you could say. So each individual sugar unit has its own individual carbonyl. We'll stick two of them together, and that is called a disaccharide. So it is a complex sugar formed by joining two monosaccharides. Through a glycosidic link. And there's four examples that we're going to learn. Two of them today, the other two next time, tomorrow. The two that we'll do today are maltose and lactose, if we could tolerate that much. Then we have sucrose, which will be the trickiest one, and solubiose, which is a sugar that is a product of the decomposition of cellulose. So let's see our first disaccharide. No, actually before that, two more terms. We could say oligosaccharide, which oligo means few, a few, several. Poly, which means many. I can't recall any oligosaccharides offhand. I know I should know a couple. Polysaccharides, that's easy. Starch. Starch is just multiple sugar units linked together like a polymer, a polysaccharide. So now these examples of disaccharides. And let's start with maltose, which let me show you one of the ways we can systematically name maltose. You might imagine that there's multiple ways we could name sugars, because as I think I pointed out in one example, we could name it blah, 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 RS, RRS, RS, RR, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 10,000 hydroxy, whatever. Of course, it's easier if we just use these names of glucose, pyranose, whatever. And so here is the name of maltose. It is 4-O, alpha D, gluco, pyranosyl, alpha, D, gluco, pyranose. Just rolls off the tongue, doesn't it? 4-O, O, as in, oh my goodness. Yes. What does this mean? Well, ignore the thing in parentheses. This is 4 alpha-D-glucopyranose. The alpha-D-glucopyranose, we've seen that before. That's not so bad. The 4 means we substitute at the 4 position. The O means we don't just substitute on the carbon. We leave the oxygen that's already there and substitute on it instead. So let's write that much of the structure. And let me just, ahead of time, point out that I'm showing you alpha maltose, which has to do with the configuration of this last sugar. What you're going to see in a moment here is that I'm going to link one sugar through its anomer to another sugar, which is going to make that linked sugar, an acetal. Acetals don't open up as easily. It's like it traps the sugar, which is a concept we'll come back to when we address this term of reducing sugars, a term you might have heard in one of your other classes. This, though, the end of the chain, that's just a hemiacetal. And so that's much easier to open. And so we could end up with alpha and beta forms of that end portion of this complex sugar. And so that's why its anomeric configuration is what we ascribe to the compound maltose itself. So here's the first, or the last sugar, I should say. And this is the 4-O alpha-D-glucopyranose part. Well, what is the substituent? Alpha-D-glucopyranose-yl. The yl ending comes from ide. So if we have alpha-D-glucopyranoside, that's one of these glycosides. In other words, close up the ring and connect through the anomeric position. All right, we'll do that. So I'm going to connect the anomer to the oxygen of the next sugar over. Now, if you are like me and you're not entirely satisfied having a curvy bond in your molecule, then that's going to require taking one or the other of the Haworth projections and flipping them upside down. Which, if we flip it 180 degrees, realize there's two things we're going to do. From the way it's drawn now, it's going to appear that what's in front becomes what's in back. But at the same time, what's on the top is going to appear to exchange and end up with what's on bottom. If we only did one of those two things, like if all I did was reverse what's pointing up and down, that's making the enantiomer, which means we'd have the L sugar instead. If all we did was to take the things in front and swap them with the back, that's again just reflection. But 180 degree turnover flip is just like a double reflection. And if we do reflection twice, that means we get the same molecule back again. Now let me just look and see which way I did it yesterday, which ring I flipped. So I'm going to flip the ring on the right and rewrite it in more conjoined form. Means I need an oxygen. Now, the other one I want to show you today is lactose, which is 4-O. O, beta, D, galactopyranosyl. D, glucopyranose.
In case you weren't aware, by the way, maltose, if you get a malt, technically that's what you're getting, something with that form of sugar added, besides just normal table sugar, which is sucrose.
Let's see. We're going to have one ring on the left. That's the galactose that's in its beta form. It's going to be attached to a glucose that I'll make in its alpha form. For both of these sugars, just left of the ring oxygen, they'll both have that CH2OH group pointed up, because these are D sugars. For galactose, in the linear form, we have the OH groups on the right, left, left, right, which means they're going to be bottom, top, top for those first three stereocenters. So there's bottom, top, top. And glucose, we already know, is right, left, right to start with. So it's bottom, top, bottom.
Now, it probably took me 50 seconds or so to write down, which means at an outside maximum, it should take you 2.5 minutes or less. But that's a really outside maximum. If it takes you that long to write one molecule, you're going to be hurting on the rest of the exam. You're going to have the structures of at least two of these disaccharides as things that you'll have to write for the exam. So again, my encouragement to practice them. Any questions of any kind?